Hello and welcome to Eye on Careers. I'm your host, Shane Phillips. And today we have a very special guest, the founder of Aramex, Mr. Fadi Gandour. Fadi, welcome to Eye on Careers.
Hello, Shane. Thanks. Good to be here.
It's Aramex is definitely one of the most iconic success stories in the region. But I always wonder, how did it start out? I mean, when you were in grade school or at the sandbox, were you a natural leader? Is it something you gravitated to, or is it something that serendipitously took place in your life?
No, I wasn't. So I think it was accidental, if you want. So I always call myself an accidental entrepreneur. It so happened that I met my partner and we discussed it, and he said, "Oh, what do you think about doing this?" And we just jumped into it. So did I know when I was a child that I was moving in a certain direction? No.
So where did you go to high school?
In Jordan.
In Jordan. And so at that point, were you a top student? Were you a Branson, maybe more challenged, or how did it?
I was a middle average student. Nothing fantastic about my grades. I was more interested in the soccer field and basketball field than I was in the classroom.
And so were you captain of the basketball team?
So I played. I'm a swimmer, so I was on a swim team, Jordan National Swim Team. I played for the class basketball. I was the goalkeeper of the soccer team. I played volleyball. So I was a hyperactive, attention deficient little boy that was running like a pinball across the school.
Okay, so you invested in your interpersonal skills more than your academic ones during the...
Totally. Boy.
And did you go to university?
Yeah, I did. I went to college in the U.S. And I was also an average student at college. So I was more interested in being an active student. So I got politicized. I went on demonstrations. I picked up issues. You name it. You know, I moved from Amman to the U.S. And in the U.S., you suddenly are faced with democracy, with diversity of opinion, stuff that I was not exposed to when I was a child in school. You know, where our schools in this region and maybe in other regions are top down schools. So patriarchal, you don't get to be a critical thinker. You just sit, listen, and memorize, and be the top student after you memorize. And how boring is that?
So you start to get politicized, but this is early leadership exposure. You're now rallying people around concepts and ideas, which fundamentally is what the entrepreneur does.
And that's when I first started feeling that I might... You know, I was passionate about issues. I was rallying people. I was debating the Arab-Israeli conflict, with suddenly being faced with issues that we thought were not debatable. I started feeling it, and it got me excited.
And so then what happened after you graduate from university? What was your degree in, by the way?
Political science.
Okay. So
not business.
Okay, and then what happens?
So what happens is I graduate, I go back to Jordan, to Amman. I work for a rent-a-car company renting cars. About 6 months, maybe 8 months, close to a year. And then along the way, I met my partner, Bill Kingston, who just passed away, by the way, in New York.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Bill,
met him in the car rental business?
No. He's a family friend. So okay. I didn't know him well. So I got to meet him at an event in France, actually. And he said he had a small courier company in the tri-state area, New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut, in the east coast of the U.S. He said, you know, there's this courier business that's just taking off, and then there's this Federal Express that is taking the world by storm, delivering packages overnight. What do you think about us doing this business in the Arab world? And I was a 23-year-old boy. I said, yes, post offices are lousy. They don't know how to deliver packages. And absolutely, Federal Express was just becoming a brand name in the U.S. So how exciting for a naive boy that didn't know how difficult it was to build a global or a business that actually delivers packages.
So ignorance was bliss.
Oh, totally.
They say totally, in a world
because
where...
Because if I had known, I wouldn't have done it.
they say if ignorance is bliss, then it's folly to be wise.
Yeah, well look, so ignorance is bliss in this case because... and that's part of the problem of when we grow up, when we're kids, because we don't know, we ask a lot of questions to discover, you know, the questions of discovery. When we grow old, we become a bit scared to ask questions. Why? Why this? Why that? Why can't we do this? So not being an entrepreneur myself, not even thinking that I can do this or how difficult it was. Yes, ignorance was a bliss. But wisdom is essential. I mean, you build your wisdom by trying many things along the way in your life. You can't be wise by sitting and watching only. You have to do.
You have to fall down and scrape your knees.
All the time. I'm a total believer that your mistakes is what you actually learn from. Mistakes are done by trying. And the ultimate learning process is trial and error. You try, you err, you stand up again and keep trying until you discover what the solution is. And then you discover later on that solution doesn't work enough or good enough. You're going to find another one and a better one. And life is a continuous story of discovery.
So what do you think of the statement, fail fast and fail often?
Yeah, I mean, that's a Silicon Valley story where they tell you, you know, fail fast and fail often because you need to keep trying. But it's, again, trial and error. It's better said than done. It's not easy. I mean, what this means in essence is it's an action-oriented statement. So fail fast meaning... Don't just keep thinking about what you want to do. Just go out and do it and try it. And the market will decide whether you're going to succeed or not. And then if it doesn't work, pivot, move into something else, and come up with a solution that is going to be acceptable to your clients or whoever you're proposing, whatever you're doing.
So the first year, so you and your family friend here say, okay, let's become the next FedEx. And then what were the first 12 months like how do you start a business that needs so much infrastructure? It's crazy, it's more
like what were the first 15 years like? So 12 months was nothing. I mean, 12 months was initial discovery. I need a license here, I need to register here, foreign investment laws are restrictive, post offices are fighting you because they think you're infringing on their monopoly. And who are you to come to my market? And, you know, you're a little boy. How can you build a business like that? How can you compete with DHL, the massive multi-billion-dollar rising star of the industry globally? So all sorts of questions, all sorts of doubters and naysayers. But that's the beauty of it, you know. That's the beauty of youth and me thinking that, okay, I can conquer the world. And so what's going to happen to me if I fail, you know? So what? I mean, I'm a nobody. And if I fail, nobody will notice. So I'm going. I'm going. Catch me. It took 15 years to build an infrastructure of delivering packages in the Arab world. You know, the Arab world is a complex market. We call it the Arab world, but it's 22 countries. And each country has its own laws. Each post office views you differently. Each legal infrastructure views you differently. Each talent base is different than the other country. I started in Jordan. It took us 9 months to get our license in Jordan. And then I started, you know, Dubai was my second market. We found partners. We found strategic alliance. Other operators who were in the market already delivering, you know, in the city. So it took a long while for us to actually understand the Arab world, master it, and build what you see today.
How important was that vision? It sounds like right out of the gates, your vision: hey, we're going to be a FedEx, we're going to be
right.
a DHL.
Right.
Putting that point on the horizon, how important is that to the success of an executive?
It's very important, but it's not the story because the vision gets blurred a bit. You don't know exactly whether you're going to make it or not. You don't know how far you're going to be going. So what I've discovered over the years is, I mean, we're talking back in the 80s here. So the Silicon Valley story had not reached the shores of this region yet. So it was learn as you go, build as you go. So 2-3 years down the work that we were doing here, we started having extreme clarity of vision. We started seeing, it's doable. We're going to go all the way. We can go all the way. We started feeling it. But then, yes, back to your question, that clarity of vision is eventually going to be extremely important for you, because you need to know that you are going to get to a place, and that's how you build your way through it. If you didn't know where you're going, you might get lost. So initially, you will pivot, you will try, you will make mistakes, but then as you start seeing it happening, then that vision is suddenly in front of you. You say, there you go. I know where I'm heading now. And then you run. And then it becomes fun.
This is Fadi Gandour, the founder of Aramex, one of the leading logistics companies in the Middle East, North African region. More of his insights and lessons learned on the top in just a moment.
Dubai Eye 103.8. Stay one step ahead.
Hello and welcome back to Eye on Careers. We are listening to the story of Fadi Gandour, the founder of Aramex, one of the leading logistics companies in the Middle East and North African region. So what's been, you know, you say the first 15 years were extremely challenging as you set up this business. What were some of your biggest failures in the early days as you set up and kind of learned the rules of the road?
I don't know if I can tell you a story of a massive big failure. I can tell you that everything that I have done in my life, not only in the early days of my career, were a continuous process of small failures, of failures in understanding and appreciating markets, in understanding and appreciating how important it is to recruit the right people in the right place at the right time, in failure to understanding that you need to be much more patient than you initially anticipate. So you end up doing some mistakes. And some people say it's good that you do these mistakes. And I say, you know, what burns your fingers is something that you're going to remember. So I can't give you a massive story of a big failure. One of the issues that that founders of companies might have is that you always tap into friends to come and work with you. And I think that's one of the big mistakes that one can do is work will trump friendship, and then you might lose those friends along the way once you disagree on the way that your business is going to go forward. So, yeah, I mean, it's an accumulation process of many trials.
Because the entrepreneur, essentially, his loyalty has to lie with the vision for the organization, and that will have to trump the loyalty to your friend.
Totally. You know, if you're an entrepreneur and you're building a business, and then you have to understand that it's going to consume you because you feel many senses of responsibility. So you suddenly have employees, you suddenly have to pay salaries, you compromise. And you wake up in the middle of the night worried about all the issues that you're facing, you're not able to get a client, that is going to consume you. If you're serious about building the business, you'd better be ready for the ultimate compromises you're going to do between family and friends. That story of balance between life and work, I mean, somebody needs to tell me where did they find it. I mean, as an entrepreneur, I had to do a lot of compromises along the way. Some of them were okay. Some of them were not. So my children might have paid a little bit of the cost of not seeing me around enough. My family life might have suffered along the way. Some of my friends might have, and my friendships might have suffered. But that's, I mean, these are the things that I might share with you here.
But most marriages won't withstand the plight of an entrepreneur.
That's tough. Mine did not.
Yours didn't.
Didn't. After, but it took 25 years. So I had a happy marriage for 25 years. So can't complain. Okay. Tell me, it was no big disaster. It's just an evolution process. But yes, it is tough to actually build a company that is going to go global and is going to go public. And you have shareholders, you have employees, you have clients, you have suppliers, you have 14,000 people that work for you. It's each wants a part of you. So you'd better be ready for that.
And it's almost like as the entrepreneur, you know, you're either business is doing well or it's bankrupt. And so any of these big, any meeting, it's life or death. And so to be in the intimate environment with an individual who's on that type of edge becomes abrasive at times.
Yeah, it's tough. So you come back home and you're tired and you're consumed and your brain is somewhere else and you need that tranquility. And that doesn't necessarily mean that people that are with you and are part of your life necessarily understand where you are. You might not understand where they are either. So it's not anybody's fault. It is the different experiences that you have during that day as individuals. If you're not able to find the common ground when you are together, because you are less together than you thought you're gonna be, because you're more at your work than you are at home. So if you don't find that common ground of space and understanding each other, your relationships in general, and this is not about marriage only, your relationships in general are going to suffer. So it's a question of dialogue, it's a question of empathy, it's a question of patience, it's a question of when to push and when not to lay off. It's a complex process.
And you know, even in business, I think on one hand, the entrepreneur is successful because of their rigidity to their vision, you know, not flexing and their ability to push through. Sure. But at the same time, it can also be the noose around their neck because that fire, that passion, you know, can push too hard, too far. And so how do you know where the limits are?
So you need to manage your ambition, because once you see yourself successful or starting to be successful, then you become extremely more ambitious than you might think that you are. You're certainly going to be very paranoid because either with failure or success, I mean, failure is a journey of that leads to success, I say also. But you are going to... have to understand that process is you effectively. You can't dissociate yourself from your work anymore. You can't be two individuals, that ambition, if not managed well, can also lead you to have a terrible life. So balance is important, and having friends around you that are gonna appreciate you and you appreciate them is absolutely essential for sanity's sake.
And navigating the business markets, as you said, 22 markets, all different structures, different legalities. But on top of it, there's also institutional voids. So, for example, these are tax-free jurisdictions. There's not a lot of data, you know, when we compare to the U.S. Right. where we can find out information, business information, right. analytics to make decisions. You have to make decisions with ambiguity. How do you deal with that? And what have been some of the bigger moments where you really have to almost bet the farm based on gut instinct?
And so today is much different. So imagine how it was back in the early 1980s, building a business in the region with practically gut feeling processes. So I lived as an entrepreneur, as a gut feeling entrepreneur. But people think that entrepreneurs work with gut feeling. It's a very difficult thing to work only with gut. I mean, you'd better be right, and your gut better be right, and most probably it's not going to be right. So the error and the mistake percentage will fly up much higher than in any other markets. I tell some American entrepreneurs, if you put the effort that we put in our business here, I mean, if we take what we do to build a business across the region into the American market, which is a 300 million people market that's totally open with clarity in terms of their regulatory environment, then you will fly high. They have it easy. I mean, this is a difficult place to build a business. And then eventually the way you create your decision making is, and that's why trial and error is big here. Now there's much more information, and your history and your your knowledge of the market is built around you testing that market. Where does it work? Where does this product work? If it works, then I'll build my own data. So we live off our own data today. We know what's happening in the market because we have such a wealth of information from our own experiences.
And
others' experiences. So we look at others and what they've done.
One of my theories is now that when you look at the Eastern businessman who or business person and women as well, they've had to build a business like you have on gut feeling. We're going to throw it up as fast as we can. If it's wrong, we'll tear it down and rebuild it. Versus the Western business person who has these analytics, they have a 4-year strategic plan and they roll it out. Now, as we move in the 21st century, your strategic plan's obsolete because you can't wait to roll it out.
Right.
Does inherently in the 21st century now, the Eastern business professional has an edge for the first time where a lot of the toolkit of the Western business professional is obsolete. You can't do a 5-year study of a market before you go in.
Right. So I will tell you, 5-year plans are to the garbage. You know, whether you're in a developed market, in a sophisticated market, in the U.S., Europe, or wherever, in the East, or in the Arab world, forget 5-year plans. Anybody that shows me a 5-year plan and 5 years later can show me that he actually did exactly what he thought he was going to do 5 years ago, there's only God can know what's going to happen in 5 years. So forget those. What you need to do is think towards 5 years and then build your on a short-term basis so that you can actually test and see if what you're building towards actually works. And the sophistication of the markets that we live in and the complexities of the markets that we live in globally and more in the Arab world, yes, makes us people in the East, in the Far East, in Asia, in Southeast Asia, much more sophisticated, much more capable in understanding how to actually maneuver the global landscape. So the big companies in the U.S. They have their growth happening in these markets. So if you look at the results of some of the major companies in the U.S., you'll find that they have single-digit growth in their markets and more than double-digit growth in emerging markets: Africa, Middle East, Southeast Asia, China. So if they want to grow, they'd better understand how to do business in this market. And that's why a brand like Aramex can actually... we are a global company. We're in 75 countries. We're not only in the Middle East. We're in Africa, and we're able to actually maneuver into the African market. Is much easier for me because we're built around complexity. We built our business in the Arab world. So going to Africa and seeing 50 different countries with 50 different regulations, we say, okay, here's how we were. So there's nothing. We're not surprised. Doesn't scare us. The risk appetite of Aramex is different than the risk appetite of Western companies who go from New York to Los Angeles with nobody asking them a single question along the way. We're used to questions, and we're used to finding solutions and answers, no matter how complex they are. Back to the study and market study issue that you raised, Shane. Steve Jobs is famous for saying, I've never built a business around a market study. The market research does not tell me anything. I have created the market. So he created demand. So some companies with a lot of product. I mean, who would have known whether Facebook was going to be something in demand, or Twitter was going to be something in demand, or even Google, or even the concept of search was going to be in demand. So market research is most of the time a hindrance. Because it tells you things, it tells you, well, the market is not ready for you. But how would the market be ready for something that it doesn't know what it is? Because it's new. And when my partner first came to me about Aramex, he says, we're going to do a study, a market research about the Aramex, about the Arab market in the courier industry. So fine. I mean, he did one. And I'll tell you, I never looked at it. Never.
This is Fadi Gundour, the founder of Aramex, giving you his insights and tips on his road to the top. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Dubai Eye 103.8, keeping you up to date with what matters in the UAE. Stay one step ahead.
Hello and welcome back to Eye on Careers. I'm your host, Shane Phillips, and we are here with the legendary Fadi Gandour, the founder of Aramex, one of the leading logistics companies in the Middle East, North African region. Fadi, welcome back to Eye on Careers.
Good to be here.
Now, when you look at it, the job of a leader is really just getting a group of people to a certain end goal, to a certain destination. There's such a toolkit to get, you know, how do you get 3,000, 5,000 people? Or how many staff do you have at Aramex now? 15,000?
It's about 14,000, yeah.
14,000 people. Yeah. What kind of toolkit do you use to get 14,000 people drumming, you know, marching to the beat of the same drummer?
Well, it's very tough to get 14,000, to get four people to march for one drummer's process. But let me tell you, leaders are this is all they do at the end of the day. Companies today are about people. People build systems so that that people can actually do their work in the best way possible to get to the results that the company wants. So in today's world, in the future, you are going to be recruiting talent, and the talented people are going to be the drivers of the company and its success. And that means motivating highly knowledgeable, highly capable people. And that is hard work because they already know what they want. They already have clarity. So you need to have a corporate culture inside the organization that gets talent to work with talent, that is meritocracy built, that has clarity of mission and vision, meaning what am I, in my mission, what is my short target, where am I heading, am I co-creating that decision-making process? They want to be part of the decision. This is the organizations of today and of the future are democratic organizations. If you don't have a voice, if you don't feel that you are making an impact as a talented person inside the organization, you're going to pack your bags and leave. And there are competitors out there. There are high-performing companies, highly capable companies today, the Googles of this world, the Facebooks of this world, that are way up there, that are going to take away your talent from you if you are not getting that talent to feel that their careers are being built inside the organization. They are being rewarded with knowledge, with money, and with maybe stock options. Eventually, they feel a sense of ownership of everything that they do. I mean, this is the role of the leader. When I'm sitting with somebody who probably knows about his job much more than I do, if I'm a leader, if I'm surrounding myself with very capable people, I'd better be able to understand how these people are going to work together, how are they going to relate to me, and how are they going to believe in the company that they work in. They need to have a sense that this is their company, that this is their brand, and then everything they touch in the organization affects the whole organization, and they need to feel that sense of pride. So when you're with your friends and you say, I'm working with Aramex, people's eyes need to lighten up and say, okay, you're working for a great organization. That sense of pride is when a leader is doing his job properly with his employees. And it's all about corporate culture.
When I'm listening to that, I feel like the subtext is really what you're saying is, you know, the job of the leader is to give the identity to his people. You know, when we look at the late Sheikh Zayed, for example, right, he gave an identity to the people of this nation. When you look at Einstein, for example, he gives an identity to physicists or scientists.
Absolutely.
Or Muhammad Ali gives an identity to the African Americans of his time.
Right.
Is this really kind of one of the tenets of good leadership, is the ability to create and deliver an identity to their followers?
Totally. And look at the great late Sheikh Zayed and the legacy that he's left behind, the Union, the UAE, and where it is today, where it was then. He saw it. He made people believe in it, and look where we are today. Nelson Mandela spends 28 years in jail, persecuted, and then look at his legacy. His legacy is not, he doesn't come out with vengeance against his persecutors. He comes out and says, I'm going to build the future of South Africa, and it's going to be everybody that lives in South Africa going together. Look that at that incredible transition. And that took one leader that says, yes, I paid 28 years of my life, but my next 28 years are going to be, how do I build the future peacefully in coexistence? Look how powerful. If he had come out, how powerful that is. If he had come out with a different statement, what would have happened to South Africa? And that's a question of leadership. Recently, the World Economic Forum came out every year. It comes out with, they had a meeting here in Dubai, and every year they comes out with the 10 big concerns of the future. The first three are economic, and the fourth one says the world lacks leaders that are going to be able to resolve the complex problems of today. So a CEO of a company, a team leader, a captain of a football team, a mayor has to be able to address micro and macro issues, and has to get people to believe through his own words and through his own action that where he is heading is worth for people to follow.
When we look at the toolkit now, and I think you've already in the previous segment basically thrown 5-year strategic planning under the bus, so we don't have to deal too much with that. But when we look at, for example, the MBA toolkit, where they're giving you create the business plan, create the KPIs, the balanced scorecard.
That's why I didn't go to business school,
Right, but aren't these are all focusing on the tangibles, right? And everything that you just talked about in terms of driving peak performance in an organization, right, is dealing with the intangibles, or what I call the collective subconscious. Right. And are we not just dealing with a blunt toolkit that does not adequately address the human factor in business today where we stand?
Totally. Skills and specific skills and specific tools that you have are extremely important, but they're off the shelf. With all due respect, with all these people that know how to manage a spreadsheet, fantastic. It's easy. Anybody can learn it. And it's learnable and it's doable, and everybody does it. The intangible side of the story, the human relations side of the story, the relating to people and how you motivate people and how you work with people and how you get people to feel that they own the decision and they own the process that they are working on today is what matters. That's also learnable. I mean, you're not going to be born by it. What you need to do is to understand it and appreciate it and work on it. Building your interpersonal skills is learnable. You need to work very hard at it, but that's what's going to distinguish you. It is not your technical skill that's going to make you superior in management, I'm saying. What's going to make you superior is how am I taking 14,000 people to actually go out and perform and feel good about their job.
As we were talking on the break, when you take a rental car, you don't take it for a car wash, or you don't take it for an oil change, because you don't own it. And in a lot of companies, people don't really own the strategy or own the ideas of what's really happening. And by there, they do just enough not to get fired. How do you as a leader get translate or create that ownership? What tactics can we actually employ to ensure that the team is taking ownership of the direction of the business?
Sure, and that's again back to the same discussion is the culture of the organization. I'll tell you, talented people will not come to an organization and to any company that with a brand that does not have that enthusiasm inside the organization. People talk. So when you have a couple of thousand people working for you in Dubai, you'd better know that your story is out there in Dubai. And people will say, I want to work for this company, or I don't want to work for this company. And if somebody does not take care of the seat that he is working in inside the organization in Aramex, believe me, Aramex is not going to grow. You're going to lose your clients, and you're not going to be a brand that is respected. The people of the organization are the representatives of the brand. And that's what makes the company different and distinguished. So washing that car comes natural to somebody who feels ownership of the car. So if you're in as somebody renting that seat, you're not going to make it anywhere, and the company will not make it with you either. So it's a two-way street. You come in, you bring all your energy, effort, knowledge, and capabilities into the organization you're working in, and your leader and the company has to be able to open up, allow you to innovate and participate in the decision making, and feel a sense of ownership that what is coming out of this company is mine. And when something is yours, you'd better feel pride about it. So that's what it is. It's a two-way street. You and the people of the future, the employees of the future, even if they don't come, you know, there's a temporary work or working out of home is part of the future work in the 21st century. So even if you're working out of your home, you need to feel that sense that you are part of a bigger family. And in family, we always take pride and we always take care of our family.
This is Fadi Gandour, the founder of Aramex, one of the leading logistics companies in the Middle East and North Africa. He'll be sharing his insights into what makes a successful executive in just a minute.
Dubai i 103.8, award-winning news, business, sport, and lifestyle coverage. Stay one step ahead.
Hello and welcome back to Eye on Careers. I'm your host, Shane Phillips, and we are here with Fadi Gandour, the founder of Aramex, one of the region's leading logistics companies with over 14,000 employees. Fadi, welcome back to Eye on Careers.
Good to be here.
So 14,000 people, you've hired one or two people in your day. What do you look for when you're hiring, you know, your top people?
But I take pride. You know, if you tell me what's my legacy in Aramex, I say, my biggest success as a leader is to have maybe by luck found incredible leaders inside the organization that have built the company with me. Most of the senior managers and middle managers in Aramex today have been in the company anywhere between 25 to 15 years. So these are people that came in and felt that this is their organization and built it and took over from me. You know, I've retired. I'm no longer running the business. So what do I look for? Who are these people? What do I look for? How did I learn that that process? So I didn't come with a skill that told me how, you know, here's the toolkit for choosing leaders of the future. Doesn't exist. But I'll tell you who these people are. These people are people that came in. They are people that believe that learning is a continuous process. People that are entrepreneurial in their thinking, meaning they're problem solvers, they're critical thinkers. They don't have a herd mentality. So they will question you. They will tell you, why are you letting me do this? There is that sense of a democratic participatory process in how they move that organization going forward. Their basic skills are important. So if he's a financial manager, he should have studied finance. But if he wants to be the leader of the financial organization inside the company, he'd better have those skills in him. So I don't look for MBAs. I don't look. You have to have a degree mostly, but what I look for is your character, is your outlook. Is are you positive? Do you understand complexity? Are you somebody who is looking for a job description? You're not going to be hired. If you tell me what is exactly give me a job description. I told people very early on, there is no job description. You will know in general what your job is going to be and you have to deliver on it. But there is going to be enough flexibility for you to actually create your own space in the job that you are doing and finding the right formula to some of the things that you do yourself as an individual. So you have to be a co-creator of your own job. It was a little bit more hierarchical in the past. In today's world, this is as flat as it gets, buddy. People will talk to each other. The boss does not know more than anyone else. And if he thinks he does, he is one heck of not a smart boss. Because believe me, people in today's world are far ahead and knowledge is so ubiquitous. The internet has changed everything. So your reputation is on Facebook, on Twitter. Knowledge is everywhere. MOOCs are all over the place in terms of the new online education courses that are going out there. People are self-learning, and they are going out and exploding in their capabilities and their knowledge. And you as a leader need to understand and nurture that. And these are the future leaders of the organization. The rebellious person inside the organization is going to give you trouble. You're going to hate it, but you're going to look at him and say, this guy is going places. This guy is going places because he's ambitious. He questions, and he's a solution seeker. He will always say, this job can be done better, and goes out and does it better. And once he does it better, he says, okay, how can I do it yet better again? These are the future leaders of any organization, or the current leaders, or the people that are building the organization that you live in.
What I take from that is that when you look at the individuals you're describing, right, they're focused on the opportunity, and the rest of the staff is focused on the obligation.
Yeah, but there's no problem with that. So I'm not against. There will be people that say, I want the 9-to-5 job, and that's fine. I mean, there's nothing wrong or against that. But you choose. If you want to be a leader, then you have to do much more than 9-to-5. You'd better live your life. There is no time for leadership. Leadership does not come in with clocking into the company in the morning and clocking out of the company in the afternoon. A leader is somebody that lives his life from the minute he wakes up until the minute he sleeps, and what he dreams is, what is he going to be doing as a leader in a family, as a leader in a business, as a leader in a non-profit organization, as a leader in government. He is somebody that is going places and knows that responsibility. He knows people are following him, and he'd better be up to it, because you're being watched all the time by everyone, and you'd better live what you say and say what you live all the time.
To live your values.
Yeah, walk the talk and talk the walk.
And I think what was interesting, what you were just touching on, is that the leader's persona or ethos has to cascade across all the realms. And one of the big trends we're seeing now is the social responsibility factor,
right,
that organizations now have this triple bottom line. How real is that in the Middle East, in the Middle Eastern business context? And to what extent should leaders be taking this idea on board?
Yeah, Shane, the social responsibility side of it is, forget the PR side of social responsibility. Social responsibility is about stakeholder view of the organization. It's about the values of the organization. Who are we? What is our character? How do people feel us? Are we only a company that actually delivers a package on time, or are we a company that is a fantastic workplace for our employees? They get trained, they get knowledge, they get rewarded well, they speak well about the company when they are with their friends and with their families. Is this company, when it touches the community that it works in, does well in that community? It has programs that empower the community that it works in. It's not only about the Middle East. This is a global story, because the Middle East cannot dissociate itself from the rest of the world. In Dubai today, there is nothing called Middle Eastern company and Western company or Eastern company. We all compete in the marketplace, and we are all competing for the same client, and we are all competing for the same talented people out there. So we'd better act on a global level in capabilities and in knowledge and in product that we're offering. So that social values inside the organization, so let's not call it corporate social responsibility, it's the values of the organization from a stakeholder perspective, from everything that it touches, is what distinguishes organization from others. And this is what brings certain talented people to certain organizations versus others. So you can't dissociate your financial performance from your social impact. They go together. And after the financial crisis of 2008-2009, companies are going to be, your clients are going to tell you, if you are not socially responsible, we don't want to work with you. Your suppliers might not work with you. Employees who are high, top-notch employees, they say, if you're not socially responsible, I am going to a sexier company, to a company that is going to appreciate me, and I'm going to feel pride. And the company without values, its employees will not feel proud, and they will leave.
And so it's almost like you're creating an ideal for people more than just the brick and mortar. You're really focused on creating this ideal, which spills into people thinking, you know, these are my values and the values of the organization are married.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, Shane, you spend more time in your company than you spend anywhere else. So you'd better be enjoying it, and you'd better feel that what you love about life is inside your organization also. I mean, if you think it's different inside the organization than outside the organization, then you're in trouble. Because when you spend 8 to 10 hours a day in a company, this is going to be a place where you're enjoying yourself. You're feeling that something good is happening to you, because that's when you give your best to it. And organizations that allow people to do that are the successful organizations today. If you think you are in the old conveyor belt, employees do one thing and one thing alone and are specialized in that one single thing, like building the T model during the Ford days, because Ford built the first conveyor belt system, forget it, you're in trouble. You are not going to be in the business today. And across the organization, from the guy that actually delivers the package and works 10 hours a day in the heat. So what I would tell a CEO or a manager or a team leader or an entrepreneur is you'd better build an organization that is going to be a place where people enjoy themselves and feel they are building the company with you. I mean, it's a simple, there's no sophistication to it. Think about it very carefully. How do I get my people to think like me in terms of the sense of purpose inside the organization? And these are people that are going to actually take the company places. To the people that work in organizations, you know, for me, I've seen inside Aramex and outside, and I'm an investor in many startups. The best people and the people that have become leaders inside the organization are people that do not necessarily follow all the rules. They are disruptors. They have an entrepreneurial mind. They are solution providers, and they care, even though they disagree with you. They might disagree with you. They might look like they're disruptors, but they are the people that are taking your company places. And you, as an individual, as an employee, think critically. Think solutions. Take responsibility to what you do, and continuously believe that you are learning all the time. You have not reached and cannot reach ever a limit of what you can learn.
Well, Thady, thank you so much for taking the time to come on the show, and hopefully we can have you on again sometime soon.
Thanks a lot. I enjoyed it a lot.
Okay, great. That was Thady Gundur, the founder of Aramex, one of the leading logistics companies. That's it for this episode of Eye on Careers. I'm your host, Shane Phillips, saying make sure the rest of your life is the best of your life.